And welcome to Monday's edition of Big Blue Kickoff Live here on Giants.com. He is Paul Dottino. I'm Lance Meadow with you for the next 60 minutes. Two ways for you to interact with us here on the program, 201-939-4513. We'll get to your telephone calls. You can also follow and interact with us on Twitter, hashtag Giants Chat. Today we're going to cover a number of different topics, Paul, considering we still have 2 weeks to go, just about, before the start of
training camp.
Well, you have
10 days before players report, baby. Are you ready?
This is what happens when Paul is on vacation for a little bit. He comes up a little amped up from vacation. We'll get to that, though, in a second, his rendezvous and everything else. I'm sure Giants Nation is certainly interested in hearing about that. But you have the 30 questions in 30 days feature up on Giants.com. We're going to start to cover a number of those questions, give you an opportunity to weigh in on that. Monday Morning Quarterback, Sports Illustrated, Paul, came out with its NFL all-time draft, meaning they drafted quarterbacks, running backs, you name it, and there were a number of Giants in the mix.
Including number one.
Yes.
Who was number 56. Surprise, surprise, surprise. Who else could it be? But a number of other Giants, including Michael Strahan, Harry Carson, Rosie Brown, they all made the list also.
So we'll get into that. And then lastly, the franchise tag deadline is today, 4 p.m. Eastern. Doesn't impact the Giants, but it does impact the NFC East, specifically with Kirk Cousins and the Washington Redskins. All that and more coming up. You can check out the remainder of the show on Giants.com. Lance Meadow, Paul Dottino with you here, Big Blue Kickoff Live. So glad you could join us on this Monday as we recap all that happened over the course of the weekend and look ahead to the rest of this week. So let's start with this all-time draft, as you alluded to, Lawrence Taylor, the number one overall pick. What Monday Morning Quarterback did was they got about 12 executives, former players, a variety of people that have been invested in the NFL, 12. And they went through round after round. They kept the order, though. It wasn't like a snake fantasy draft where
right.
If you draft last, you then get the first pick in the second round. Kept the same order, 1 through 12.
Or like a real NFL draft would be.
Exactly, as opposed to the fantasy angle. And Lawrence Taylor was the number one overall pick, followed by Joe Green, and then Johnny Unitas rounded out the top three. I think the biggest surprise of the first round was that Ray Guy, Hall of Famer. But you don't see a punter that you would think be selected number four overall in the entire draft by Dan Fouts.
I didn't understand that one either, despite the fact that Ray Guy certainly had a tremendous impact on games when he was punting for the Raiders, and I get that, but, I mean, come on. You can't. You just can't do it.
Well, my biggest surprise, and I told you this off the air, is when you have an all-time draft, you have an overwhelming amount of talent at all of the skilled positions. So you don't have to take a quarterback first. You don't have to take a wide receiver. You don't have to take a running back.
No, but you have to take LT first.
That's
because
fine.
He's the greatest defensive player who has ever walked the earth.
And I have no problem with that. You are not going to see me argue. I don't even want to think about arguing
no,
with you on that topic. It's not even
don't.
Worth it. It's a lost cause. But the point that I was going to get is I would then focus on the trenches. In addition to Lawrence Taylor, I'd focus on my offensive line. I would want to grab the best overall offensive line. And then, as I get into the later rounds, then I would start focusing on the skill positions.
And I totally understand that perspective because we always say it's all about the trenches. Now, you know, you're talking about offensive linemen. You're also, to some degree, talking about defensive linemen, too. You can throw them in
of
that
course.
Hat and say, well, why didn't those guys go a little bit higher as well? But, hey, you know, the skill position guys, very sexy. We understand that. People like the big numbers. And so as a result, a lot of those guys went very, very high. I mean, you know, there are so many people who you talk to who are going to say, well, right away, you know, the Tom Brady's, the Johnny Unitas's, the Joe Montana's, the Emmitt Smith's, the Walter Payton's, the Jim Brown's. They're going to come up with those skill position guys because I think when the guy on the street talks about who are the top 10 players who have ever played the NFL, I think most of them are going to go to the quarterbacks, the running backs, and the wide receivers. And while everyone's going to name Lawrence, he's probably the only defensive player that anyone would name if you said, give me your top 10 all-time players. Nobody thinks about defensive players. They all think about quarterback, running back, wide receiver.
I mean, I think you make a fair point. I think Reggie White's name, though, is more than not often thrown around. You wouldn't say that. I think Reggie White comes to mind, other than Lawrence Taylor, when you think about overall great players in NFL history. I think it's limited, and I understand your point. And you rarely hear corners. You rarely hear about safeties, but you do hear about defensive linemen. I think Lawrence Taylor and Reggie White.
See, I'd go Deacon Jones over Reggie White.
Well, Deacon Jones, who obviously played before the sack even existed. If the sack existed when he played, I think he'd get even more recognition.
He was
That's
just
the problem.
A monster.
Yeah. That's what hurts his reputation, I think, overall, Paul, is the fact that even though he basically created the sack and the term came out of his play. The problem is though, he doesn't have the sack numbers associated with him. So I don't think people give him enough recognition.
But I will tell you this. I mean, I still think that Reggie White and Michael Strahan were the two greatest defensive ends all around defensive ends that I've covered during my career. Now, Deacon Jones was near the end when I started watching football. And so I do remember him, but I can't say that I had the experience and the knowledge of the game to appreciate him as well as I should have and could have. But, of course, I've known people who saw him in his prime, and I've watched film, and Deacon Jones was a beast.
Yes. Well, that's why I think it's hard for most people to properly evaluate his game, as you just alluded to. But what you also brought up was the fact that when you talk about the best defensive players, you want to consider not just their ability to get to the quarterback, but their ability to stop the run. Reggie White, Lawrence Taylor, Michael Strahan, I think all fit that category in terms of
Lawrence being a linebacker, but
yeah, but still, I mean, I'm thinking more pass rushers, I guess, is what I'm talking about, as opposed to just defensive ends versus linebackers. So those were some of the observations in terms of the overall draft. Strahan, I believe, went 108 overall.
Yeah.
Was where he was selected. Rosie Brown went in the 70s, just to give you a round out.
They went 12 rounds, I believe, right?
I believe they did go 12 rounds. You know, I didn't look through every single round, but let's see. No, they went further than that. Let's see. They went, in total, you've got 26.
26 rounds.
26 rounds.
And I believe somewhere,
which would be a total of 312 selections. Yeah. Well, you know what? They drafted, in fairness, though, Paul.
It was only 12.
One of the final rounds was coaches. So they really, truly went 25 rounds of players, and then the 26th round was coaches.
And by the way, you'll notice Bill Parcells did not make it.
That's right. Wow. Interesting.
Nor did Tom Coughlin.
But Bill Belichick did.
Yeah.
In terms of some guys from the tree that you associate with Bill Parcells. Lombardi was the first coach selected, followed by Bill Walsh and Marv Levy.
Some of the other Giants who made it, Andy Robustelli, Harry Carson, Mel Hine, you know, it's the creme de la creme. However, I will tell you this, okay, there are two Giants who did not make the list, and I'm not going to just go, you know, all blue-colored glasses here and just tell you that there are a ton of Giants who belong on the list. But it's very hard for me to understand why Sam Huff is not there when I do believe he's one of the top five or six middle linebackers who have ever played the game. I was a bit surprised to see him not make it.
Understandable.
And I think Frank Gifford.
You know, that
has
was
a
the
good,
next guy that I was going to ask because you didn't mention him.
I mean, I should say excuse, but a good call.
I'm really surprised, actually. That was an oversight on my part. You know, when you think about the greatest Giants, the fact that nobody even took him by the 25th round or something like that.
Well, you consider that Gifford was a Pro Bowl pick at running back, at wide receiver, and also at defensive back in his career.
Jack of all trades.
I mean,
more of a reason to select him because you can move
and threw more career touchdown passes than any non-quarterback in NFL history, because the Giants used to use a halfback option quite often when he was playing. I mean, I know his overall stat totals don't blow you out of the water. You know, in fact, when you look at the Giants' all-time record, you look and you say, well, which ones does he own? He doesn't, you know. Tiki's got the rushing record. Toomer's got the receiving record. Brandon Jacobs has the touchdown record. You know, you say, well, Gifford doesn't own any of the records. Maybe that's why he got overlooked. I don't know, but it's hard for me to understand why Frank Gifford would not have been somewhere in the top 250 players of all time. After all, he is in the Hall of Fame.
No, I think that's a very valid point. I think people who want to put things in perspective should understand the reason why he's probably not the holder of most of those records anymore is, number one, since he played so many different positions, he wasn't stockpiling numbers, Paul, at just one position. Whereas guys like Brandon Jacobs and Eli Manning, they're focused on one position. It's a little bit easier to stockpile.
Toomer, Barber,
yeah.
No question.
So, I mean, you have to at least take that into consideration.
Plus, he missed that season, you know, and a half when he was knocked out by Benarek.
Of course. And the game has evolved and the game has changed too. That's why it's very difficult to compare players, especially in football, from one generation to another. 201-939-4513 is the telephone number, hashtag Giants Chat. Before we get to your tweets, before we get to your phone calls, just to bring it back to the current game, as I mentioned, the franchise tag deadline, 4 p.m. Eastern Monday. The reason, normally it's July 15th, but since July 15th fell on the weekend, that's why they moved it to the 17th this year. And the most notable name is probably Le'Veon Bell, but I don't think anybody's talking so much about the Steelers running back. But he is, in all seriousness, when you think about the players that haven't gotten a long-term deal done, he should at least be a part of the conversation. Instead, the
He's not going anywhere.
No, of course. Well, that's why I don't think anybody's overly concerned. That's why the big part of the conversation is obviously Kirk Cousins, who was given the franchise tag last year. He played under the tag, and in all likelihood, according to the reports, he's going to play under the tag this year as well. So this all of a sudden starts to spark the debate. Is he worth a long-term contract? What is he thinking? What are the Redskins thinking? But I think what's lost in this conversation, and it was something, Paul, that you and I talked about off the air, what a lot of people are overlooking is, number one, you can use the franchise tag 3 years in a row. So they still have that option. Now, with that being said, well, they have the option to do that again next year. Remember, they used the franchise tag in 2016 when they redid the CBA. You can use it. This was the Drew Brees argument with the collective bargaining agreement, whether or not he used it the first time with the San Diego Chargers.
You're right.
Remember? And then the Saints only could use it two more times. So three times.
Because there's a loophole.
Yeah, but the reason why people are saying, well, but that's not realistic is because when you think about it, they'd have to give him $34 million.
The number's insane.
Yeah, the numbers are insane. So realistically, it's unlikely they're going to use the franchise tag. Okay, so we can move past that. But they can still use the transition tag, which I think gets lost in translation when you think about what you could do to protect players so that they don't leave. And I'm surprised that, number one, the money is less with the transition tag. And then what I think the transition tag helps teams do is you can better assess the market, since teams that sign a player to an offer sheet do not have to sacrifice any assets. They don't have to give up draft picks. They have to do that if you give a guy an offer sheet who has the franchise tag. So I'm surprised that, and hindsight's 20/20, if I'm the Redskins, Paul, and I go back to 2016, I would have been giving Kirk Cousins a transition tag every single year. You could do that as long as the guy doesn't sign a long-term deal. And then this way, every year, you could tell Kirk, go out, get offers. If you want to sign an offer sheet,
we could always match it.
And we could always match it, exactly. That, to me, is a better option to assess the market, as opposed to now, you're really negotiating against yourself.
Well, plus the fact that because the transition tag is lower, if you know, if you don't get any offers, if Kirk Cousins comes back and says, well, okay, no takers, well, guess what? The transition tag is a cheaper price than the franchise
tag. Well, that's the other benefit, of course. Yeah.
So, you know, you win on that one if you're the Redskins.
From a financial standpoint. Now, I mean, I don't know where you stand. I know we've had conversations back and forth. I think Kirk Cousins has shown me enough that I would invest long-term in Kirk Cousins. I don't need to see more from him.
He made me do a 180. When Kirk Cousins played at the end of the season in 2014 and had a couple of good games there at
the
end,
that's where he filled in.
I thought he was a flash in the pan. I didn't think he was legit, and he did not concern me as an opponent in the NFC East. Well, forget that. Kirk Cousins is a dangerous quarterback. Now, having said that, they needed a win, did the Redskins, in the season finale last year to make the playoffs, and the Giants went down there, and they took care of business, and they made Kirk Cousins look very, very ordinary that day. And quite frankly, it's like this spectacular season that Kirk Cousins had, boom, landed in a thud when the Giants defense just shut him down cold in the final week of the season. I remember talking to Larry Michaels, the Redskins radio play-by-play guy, in the booth before the game. We were just kind of chatting it up. And he said, this is where Kirk Cousins is going to have to make his contract. Because he's got – everything he's done to this point's great, but he's got to get them into the playoffs. This is the step he's got to take if he really wants to get the Redskins to fork over big money on a long-term deal. And maybe that's exactly the point here and why the Redskins haven't given him a long-term deal. I think he's deserved it. I think he's done enough that I would give him one. But maybe the Redskins don't feel that way because the Giants beat him last year.
Well, listen, I understand where you're going with that.
That's where Larry was going.
Well, in fairness, then I'll voice it, Larry's perspective. I completely disagree with him. And here's why I completely disagree with him, Paul. Number one, I think it's not being open-minded to judge a guy based on one game. Now, the counter-argument to that you're saying is, well, you need to judge a guy on the big stage when it's a meaningful contest. Fine. So he didn't deliver. I thought the Redskins overall did not play a very good game in addition to Kirk Cousins. But what about 2016? Kirk Cousins on the road in Philadelphia. 15. On the road in Philadelphia, an opportunity to clinch a playoff spot, and what does he do? He plays a very good game, yeah, and he gets him into the postseason. So to say that Kirk Cousins hasn't been tested on the big stage and hasn't gotten the team in the playoffs is overlooking what he did the previous year.
I would guess, and again, I'm not in the Redskins' brain trust, I would guess that him losing a home game at FedEx to the Giants when the Giants supposedly had nothing to play for,
and I get
I'm guessing that's a pretty big blemish for them.
And I get that, but I also think to counter that and to balance that out, going on the road late in the season and helping wrap up the division to me is just as impressive. So
I'd give Kirk Cousins a long-term deal. Now, again, it's not my money, so I don't know. I don't know how far apart they are in terms of the numbers. No one's actually said that anywhere. Have you seen that?
The only thing that I've seen is the latest report was that there was a five-year offer discussed recently, but I don't know if it was the Drew Brees contract. Remember, Brees, he got, when he was discussing the franchise tag, he got a five-year, $100 million deal. I don't know if it was in that vicinity. I don't think it was, because Derek Carr just got an average of $25 million a year, and supposedly the Redskins were more in the border of that 21 to 23
million. I was just going to say, you know what, if I'm the Redskins, I could probably swallow the fact that Kirk Cousins needs to be paid in the top 10 quarterbacks in the league. Well, I could say that's a reasonable number for him. I don't think he's a top five, top six kind of guy, but you could probably say, based on the numbers he's put up over the last two seasons, and they've been very, very impressive, you could probably give him top 10 quarterback money and say that's reasonable.
Listen, at this point, it's all about the market, Paul. It's not
The market inflates everything, though.
But that's more of a reason.
You know, if he wants to be a top three paid quarterback in the league, I'm telling him, hey, go sit on a stool somewhere. I'm not giving it to you.
Well, you could tell him that, but I guarantee you somebody is going to tell him, I'm going to take that stool and I'm going to make you feel much more comfortable, okay? Because the demand for that position is so high and so important to not just the longevity of a team, but the short-term success of a team. If you don't have an answer at quarterback, it can hold you back from making the playoffs.
You know
that better than anybody. And the point I'm bringing up is, if Derek Carr just got a long-term extension and he's played 3 years in the NFL, Kirk Cousins is right around that same period of time in terms of being a starter. So if you're the representatives, Paul, for Kirk Cousins, how do you not go to the Redskins and say, Derek Carr has 3 years under his belt. My client has two. Yeah, I think it's reasonable to ask for that
same type of money. Mr. Agent, you're not getting that kind of money from me.
Well, this is where the hardball comes into play. But I guess what I'm saying is, I would not blame Kirk Cousins' reps for taking that argument.
I'm sure they could take that argument, but ultimately, you got to find a number somewhere in the middle if you're going to reach a deal, and that's why right now they appear to be stuck in a holding pattern. I would say this: that's not the only story in the NFC East that we're watching as Giants folks, because this whole Cowboys thing, there's a very cloudy headline that keeps swirling around Ezekiel Elliott's head, and who knows? Who knows what's going to happen with them? So here we are, as we are 10 days away from the Giants reporting for training camp. And there is certainly some potential controversy surrounding the Cowboys, and maybe some bad news coming down the pike. We just don't know. And Kirk Cousins and the Redskins still haven't gotten their thing squared away. And who knows what the impact, whatever happens with the Kirk Cousins thing today, who knows what the impact is going to be. Now, he bet on himself last year, and I think he won.
No doubt. No, I believe he did win. I mean, I you could say it's premature, but how could you argue that he didn't win?
I think he did.
Great position.
But
got the leverage.
How's he going to react if he has to get tagged again this year and says, you know what, I did everything I was supposed to do? Is he going to have the same mentality?
In terms of the desire to go out?
In terms of the desire to be all in with the Redskins after potentially feeling dissed, if you will?
I think you have to. Because
you know him and his agents are saying, like what you said, why can't he get top three quarterback money? Well, the market's been set. Why can't he get it? And if he doesn't get it, is it going to affect him?
I don't know that it will, Paul, because as I mentioned, if they give him the franchise tag, which I don't think they would next year because of the money, even if they give him the transition tag, and he has to play under that, then the Redskins are running out of options. So he's eventually then going to hit the free agent market without a long-term contract. He can't afford to be in a position where, you know, hey, I'm just going to go through the motions because he's playing still for another contract. So I don't know if he can afford to have that mindset. And Kirk Cousins seems to be the guy just listening to him and watching him play. He's still got that chip on his shoulder because of where he was drafted, you know, perhaps making a statement that he could have gone sooner. They went with RG3. He was the insurance policy. He clearly has succeeded in Washington far more so long-term than RG3 has. So I think he's always going to have that chip on his shoulder.
So Redskins, Cowboys, they've got news stories kind of swirling around. The Giants, it's all quiet here at the facility. You mean you could hear a pin drop?
Well, and you're back, though, so that changed.
I am back!
Bit. Yes.
And the Eagles, don't
quiet
hear much
too.
Coming out of there.
Yeah, relatively quiet. The only thing that was interesting was Doug Peterson came out. I saw it. He's very confident in terms of the roster, of the makeup. But
every coach should be.
Well, and that's exactly what I was going to say. I was going to say the exact same thing. Whenever you overreact to comments like that, I think you're not realizing that. What do you expect the head coach of his team to come out and say? You know what? I think we're the fourth best team in the NFC East, Paul. What do you think? Does that exude confidence? It's just like, I don't know if you saw Dak Prescott recently at the ESPYs said that he thinks the Cowboys are going to repeat as division champs. What do you think he should say? They're going to finish fourth in the division? Come on.
If he doesn't, there's something wrong.
That's my point. So any of those headlines, any fans in the NFC East who go crazy over that, you got to dismiss it.
Now, both of those guys are wrong, and that's okay.
And you're entitled to those opinions, too. But
they're more than what was I going to say? They're more than welcome to be wrong, and I believe they both are. But they should feel that way.
Well, they should feel it, and the beauty of everything is talk is cheap in the NFL because at the end of the day, you have to go out and back it up. But we will allow you to talk on this program.
Finally.
At 201-939-4513. We're going to open up the phone lines, hashtag Giants Chat. We'll get to your tweets, talk about the franchise tag deadline, focusing on the NFL all-time draft. If you want to get into some Giants subjects as well, as we mentioned, the 30 questions in 30 days feature is up on Giants.com. We started a few weeks ago. There's a new question revealed every single day leading up to the start of training camp. We haven't discussed a lot of these questions at all on the show, so we want to try to invite you to weigh in on some of the questions each and every day we'll throw out two or three to get the dialogue going on that front. But in the meantime, let's get your phone calls. Bash is in Ohio. He gets us started on Monday's edition of Big Blue Kickoff Live. Bash, how we doing?
How we doing, Paul? How we doing, Lance?
Hi.
Paul, you touched on a little bit I wanted to discuss today about the Ezekiel Elliott Cowboy situation they got going on. I heard good news over the weekend about the possibility of one or two game suspension. So I wanted to call and ask, how would that impact week one game against the Giants? And how would that affect the Express game? Where I believe, so if it was correctly, Elliott played every game last year, all 17 games.
Yeah.
So how would that impact the game, the week one game, if that is upheld? And how would that affect the Express game as well?
Well, number one, he hasn't been suspended. So, I mean, I understand you're saying if anything's upheld. The league hasn't done anything. Supposedly, according to reports, there's an investigation. This incident that was reported today, we don't know a lot of the facts. I think it's really open-ended in terms of what happened, and I don't think this has anything to do with the investigation, though it's never good if a player is involved in consistent behavior like that. With that being said, Paul, I think in terms of the running game, if you just want to speculate, if they went a specific amount of time without him, what you have to understand is the Cowboys, I think, are in a very good position depth-wise at the running back position. Let's not forget, they have Alfred Morris, who has plenty of starting experience as a Washington Redskin, and they also have Darren McFadden, who actually had a really good season 2 years ago before they even drafted Ezekiel Elliott, and McFadden stayed healthy. They actually had a really good running game when they had the down year and Romo was hurt. So, honestly, Elliott's a great running back, but I think when you have that offensive line and you have two experienced running backs,
the offensive
I think they're going to be in a good position.
It's got two changes, though.
It does, but
so it's not the same.
It does, but keep in mind, and we were talking to Mickey Spagnuolo last week, who covers the Cowboys for Cowboys.com, one of the players that is going to be moved into one of those spots is a player that has had a lot of starting experience with the line, who is Lyle Collins.
No question.
So, really, to me, it's more of one new face is going to be thrown into the Cowboys' offensive line as opposed to two. They have to work out chemistry. I get that, and I think that's a valid point. But I don't see that big of a downgrade is the way that I'm looking at it, that they're taking so many new faces and throwing them in the mix. They still got three Pro Bowlers on that offensive line. Mm-hmm. I think you can't overlook that. So I'm looking at more in terms of the experience that they have at the running back position and the offensive line. While I think it's attractive to make a whole storyline out of if they lose one player, all of a sudden the team's going to fall downhill.
You know,
I just don't know if that really is truly going
to
happen.
That would also be to diminish what Ezekiel Elliott did for that team last year. To suggest that it's not that big a deal basically says that he was not a superstar and a difference maker last year, and I think he was.
Well, but here's the reason.
There is a drop-off.
Well, but I'm looking at, once again, what Darren McFadden did 2 years ago. And if you go back, I'll bring up the numbers. Darren McFadden had an extremely impressive season, and remember, he didn't have a reliable quarterback playing under center. Think about how many quarterbacks they went through. You know, Matt Cassel, Brandon Whedon. Darren McFadden in 2015 ran for 1,089 yards. He had nearly 5 yards per carry, and he was also involved as a receiver. He had 40 receptions for about 330 yards.
He's an experienced back who has
in the NFL.
Somewhat of a decent resume. That's true. But, you know, if you're going to tell me that the Cowboys aren't taking much of a hit with Zeke on the bench, I'm sorry. I'm going to say it is a hit.
Well, they're taking a hit. I guess the way that I'm saying it is, I don't think it's as significant of a hit as perhaps everybody else makes it out to be. I'm not saying it's not a hit. It's just when you have structure in place in terms of your line and depth, experience depth at the running back position, mm-hmm. I think you can make way and make do without perhaps your starting running back. I think you got to look at it. What about this, Paul? What if you go back to the Denver Broncos, the years where they had some injuries and Terrell Davis retired, and think about all those guys that ran for 1,000 yards.
Yeah.
Did that downgrade Terrell Davis, or did it say, you know what, Denver's got a good system.
Yeah,
got
well,
a good
Davis ran
line.
For 2,000 yards,
well,
though.
But to get Mike Anderson, who's not a household
I understand
name, and
that.
Get him to run for 1,000, I think that says something about the structure of your team, no?
It does.
So that's where I'm going with that. That's my point.
All right.
So, we'll let you continue. I don't know if you got more to say, Bash. I'm sorry. We got off on a tangent there.
Also,
yeah.
I just one more question. As far as how does that change next game as far as their game plan or as far as next Prescott playing, as far as about Z playing, does that change the game plan or how the Giants game plan against them or how Prescott game plan against the Giants with him not in the game? Would that change?
Well, if you go back to last season, what they tried to do early in the year is, obviously they wanted to ride Ezekiel Elliott in the running game, which you can understand they'll do with any young quarterback. Any team should want to do that so that the quarterback doesn't have to air it out. I think as the season progressed, they let Dak Prescott flap his wings a little bit more. But here's the good news for the Giants. The Giants are a good matchup against the Dallas Cowboys, no matter who the running back
is. That
is
correct.
And no matter who the quarterback is. So I don't think it changes things drastically in terms of game plan for the Giants, because you still want to stop the Cowboys' running game because you want Dak Prescott to have to make plays, which is what they did in the second matchup here at MetLife Stadium, and they took away the running game and they forced Dak Prescott to make plays, and he had a hard time because of the secondary, how well the Giants secondary played. So from a strategy standpoint, Bash, to answer your question, I don't think it changes how the Giants go about their business defensively, and I'll go so far to say, because of my point of the offensive line, I don't think it changes the Cowboys' strategy, because I think all they're going to do is, okay, if we don't have Zeke, we put in McFadden, we put in Morris, and we're still going to attempt and challenge the Giants at running the football. So I don't think the big picture changes at all. All right, Bash?
All right, appreciate it, fellas.
You got it. Appreciate the phone call. Thanks so much for weighing in here.
I think the biggest difference would be if the Cowboys were in a clock-killing situation in the fourth quarter. I really think that Elliott, at this point in time, even though he's only been in the NFL for 1 year, is one of the best grinders
I would agree with you
in
there.
The league.
I think that's a very good point.
And I don't know that the Cowboys would be in position to run off a 7 or 8 minute grind him out kind of drive in the fourth quarter to help milk a lead if he was not there.
With one running back.
Yeah.
I don't think
they could do it.
They could attempt to do it with sort of a committee, but Elliott's the guy that you don't have to take out of the game. I think that's fair.
That's fair. Where I think the biggest impact could be felt.
Situational football.
And you know what? He's real good at that.
Yeah. No, I think perhaps those nuances of the game are things that you could maybe take into consideration.
Of course.
They take the most significant hit.
Of course, the Giants will be leading them in the fourth quarter both times they played them this year anyway, so it won't make much difference.
Well, in an ideal circumstance, that would be a good position, and then they'll be in the position to run out the clock, and they won't have to worry about
it. I don't know with who, but hopefully it will be somebody.
Well, that's why training camp is around the corner to find out what those battles are going to be like. All right, let's head back to the phone lines. Nick is in the Meadowlands. Nick, what's happening?
Hey, fellas, how are you?
Doing well, Nick. What do you got for us?
Good. I walked right in the middle of what you guys were talking about. With what is this list that you guys are talking about?
Monday Morning Quarterback, SI.com. They took 12 front office executives, and they did their all-time draft. That's what we were talking about. It's up on their website. You can check it out. It's 25 rounds. So they went through any player was available, current, former. There were no limitations.
You can go to my Twitter page. I posted a link to it earlier this morning.
Yeah.
Well, I walked in when you said Lawrence Taylor was drafted number one.
Yes.
Right.
Finally, they get something right. Finally, all these lists that have him three and all these, you know, because it wasn't fair because he could line up anywhere or take him out of being one of the best pass rushers ever. I mean, finally, because wasn't Lawrence Taylor drafted number two overall?
George Rogers was taken first by the Saints, and I'll give you a really quick, funny story about this. The Giants, in the worst way, wanted LT. This is back in 1981 in that draft, and they were picking number two. And the Saints are picking number one, and Bum Phillips ignored all the advice of the other Saints football executives because he wanted George Rogers. He was like, George Rogers is a beast. George Rogers is great. George Rogers is going to give us a great offense. We're going to control the clock. We're going to batter people. Remember, he had Earl Campbell in Houston.
Oh, yeah.
So he wanted a power back. That's the guy he had to get his hands on. And the Giants were like, oh, man, please take George Rogers. Please take George Rogers. Because everybody in the Giants offices wanted Lawrence Taylor. And, of course, Bum Phillips, again, ignoring the advice of all the other Saints people, I'm going to get George Rogers. Bang, he takes George Rogers. My understanding is the smiles and the celebration in the Giants' war room, the second that Bum Phillips took George Rogers was off the charts. Bill Parcells in particular, who at the time was defensive coordinator with the Giants, was absolutely just lit up like a Christmas tree. So happy that they were going to get Lawrence Taylor.
Wow. I mean, he fell right into their lap. That's great.
Yep.
You know,
that's what happens
in
sports a lot.
That little lesson right there, Paul. Hey, he would have been drafted number one no matter what on my list. You know what I mean? And other guy, you were saying Deacon Jones. What was Deacon's last year? When wasn't it in the early 80s when he retired?
No, Deacon Jones retired, I want to say, mid-70s.
Mid-70s, okay.
That's why I only saw him at the end.
Before they even started taking down, you know, like making it a list, you know, of sacks. So yeah. I heard him speaking one time, and he said if they would have had that, he had like 24 sacks in a year, one season, he said.
I believe the Society of Pro Football Research, you know those guys, Lance? They're really good guys, and they have done an all-time unofficial sack list for careers. And you would be amazed at how many guys that they have found through their research, and of course Elias does not recognize it as official, okay? But through their own research, they have an unofficial list, and there are quite a few guys who had more than 20 in a season. You know, we all know that, you know, Lawrence had the record, then Strahan did what he did. Gastineau for a while had the record. But there are a bunch of guys who had more than 20 sacks in a season, including Jack Gregory, when he played for the Giants back in the early 70s, had over 20 sacks in a season. But nobody ever talks about that because the stat wasn't official. There are also a bunch of guys who have 150, 170, like 190, 200-something sacks, according to the unofficial list. So, yeah, what you're saying is true. Deacon Jones would have, like, this astronomical number.
I have the unofficial stats up in front of me. He played till 1974. That was his last season. According to the unofficial sack numbers, Deacon put together three seasons of 20 or more sacks. The highest he had in a season, according to, once again, these are unofficial, is 22. Sacks did not become 22. An official statistic until 1982, which was the year after Lawrence Taylor was
320s.
Drafted. Yeah.
And Lawrence Taylor had, what, 9.5 his rookie year?
Yeah. Lawrence, unfortunately, they don't credit him for that rookie season. But if you do... Okay,
would
this
have
is
142 or something. Well, right?
He's tied with Strahan. Now, Elias says Strahan is the Giants' all-time sack leader. The Giants have to recognize him as such. I don't do that. And Michael's a friend of mine. Lawrence, I get along with great. I'm sorry, they're tied. I'm not ignoring Lawrence's, you know, rookie season because, by the way, not only was he, you know, a rookie of the year. But he also helped get the Giants into the playoffs. To ignore his sack total that season is to ignore that season exists. I can't do that.
That 86 season, forget about it. MVP, Defensive Player of the Year.
Yeah.
You know, the sack leader. I mean, and I don't think anybody's ever going to get 10 Pro Bowls on the Giants. I hope they do. I hope one of these guys do. But Lawrence is, I think he's going to, LT's going to hold that one for a long time. But what was I going to say? So building this draft, do you guys have your own little in mind? Like you were talking defense, Paul. Who's at middle linebacker? Singletary, Lewis? Who do you think? Reggie White on there, you know?
Defensive
like you said,
line?
Joe Green
well, White was
on
a top
line.
10 pick in this draft, so.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Joe Green went in the top.
Joe Green went in the top.
As well.
He was number two.
I mean.
I want the whole Dallas offensive line. From the early 90s. I want
Larry
that,
Allen and company. Well, that's what I would do. I would go after the offensive lineman. That's what I would do.
Either Moose or Allstott. You know, I'd go with Moose.
That's the way to win football games.
Running back. Who are we going to go with? You put Jim Brown back there. Him and Moose are just going to run over
everybody.
How
could you not have Jim Brown? I know.
Well, but by that time, you could draft somebody else. I think with that offensive line, I don't really think you need Jim Brown to have success on the ground.
By the way, the unofficial total for Deacon Jones, 14 years, okay? 191 games, 14 years, 173.5 sacks.
Well, I mean, and listen, everybody's gone back into the archives, and they've tried to compute everybody's totals. And, Nick, appreciate the phone call. I want to try to get to a few more calls.
One more thing, guys.
Yeah, real quick.
Paul, you were talking about Derek Thomas. He wasn't much of a run stopper.
He was not.
But wouldn't you agree with me that he was the fastest guy you've ever seen off the ball?
He was one of them. He was right up there.
Who's the other one?
Oh, I think OC was lightning quick.
Yes.
OC was lightning quick.
You're the man, Paul. You're the man. You great minds think alike. All right, man. Have a great day.
Appreciate the phone call. I think Nick's just trying to get you to name as many Giants as humanly possible. That seems to be the theme here.
I'm starting to get a bead on his MO.
I mean, you know, Lawrence Taylor, OC Majora. I mean, there's other guys that have played in the NFL that I think we're entitled to talk about. Related to the Giants, this is just breaking news that we're finding out here. The Carolina Panthers have relieved Dave Gettleman of his duties as general manager, the former assistant general manager here in the Giants front office. So this is rather surprising considering what he's been able to do in a short period of time. So we'll find out more info on that front. But the Panthers have cut ties with Dave Gettleman. It's not so much that this news is surprising. That goes without saying. It's more of the timing. To get rid of a general manager right now when you're about to start training camp and beginning the evaluation period. We've seen the Kansas City Chiefs do it. There's been a lot of movement in the front office. Have you noticed that, Paul, for teams during the course of the offseason, which we have not seen in quite some time. But this just in, the Panthers parting ways with Dave Gettleman.
Yeah, that's a stunner for me.
He was only there 4 seasons, and they finished – first in the NFC South in 3 of Gettleman's 4 seasons. And remember, he inherited a situation where that salary cap was not convenient.
No.
The salary cap circumstance when he first took that job, very surprising that the Panthers have gone in a different
direction.
Does
it indicate who the replacement is?
I have not seen anything. I'm just perusing tweets, and I know that the Panthers just issued a statement. We'll check out.
Okay.
My guess is they have not announced who is going to take over, or maybe they have somebody on an interim basis. But as we know more on this, we'll let you know. But Dave Gettleman out as Panthers general manager. All right, let's head back to the phone lines. We've got Christian in New York. Christian, what's happening?
Hey, guys.
How we doing?
I know they signed Brandon Marshall for this kind of thing, but something I've noticed with the Giants is they don't really have Odell just high point a lot of balls very often. Because, I mean, I know some defensive backs are, you know, a couple inches taller than him, but, I mean, if you just see, like, the times that they do, he high points the ball as good as, like, pretty much any other receiver I watch. And it just seems like they could kind of utilize him for that more. I mean, now that Brandon Marshall is there, that's more his thing now. But it just seems like there's a lot of plays where you could just throw it up there as if he's...
Well, you're talking about you want to see more throws that put Odell Beckham in that position? Is that what you're talking about? That you think that's lacking in this offense?
Yeah, it seems in the last couple of years where, you know, you could basically throw just like some fades to him in the end zone. I mean, I know
he doesn't
catch any back shoulder balls, really.
I mean, I remember that throw that Eli threw to Beckham. I think it was the Bengals game, Paul. Was that the game where he put a move on Pac-Man Jones? Mm-hmm. Remember Pac-Man ran in circles because Beckham basically did a little dance around him? And that was, you know, towards the corner of the end zone. So they've run some formations where they try to get him out in open space. But, I mean, this is just my personal opinion, Christian. I don't think the Giants need to worry about where and how high they're getting Odell Beckham the football. If anything, I think maybe you could look to where you line him up to give the defense different looks, but I don't think where they're throwing in the football has impacted the offense.
Well, I just mean that, you know, it's kind of like with other big receivers, if they're covered, they're open because they can just go up there and get it. And I'm not saying they should put emphasis on it. I'm just saying that, you know, it only happens a couple times a year, it seems. And he just got such good leaping ability and so able to high point the ball. And if you take, like, screenshots of him, he's, like, looks like he's a foot in the air more than the defensive back.
Well, that's why I think as long as you have a favorable matchup with Odell Beckham, as long as Eli puts it in a position where Odell can make a play, I mean, that's what matters. I mean, your point is well taken in terms of, I would agree with you. Odell Beckham's the type of wide receiver that if I have a one-on-one matchup with Odell Beckham, if I'm Eli Paul, I think I would be of the mindset I could throw the ball up and take a risk because I think Odell's going to come to my rescue and help me make the play.
Mm-hmm.
Based on what we've seen, I think he's very effective in doing that.
I don't think there's any question about that. I mean, you know, ask Carr.
Exactly.
But to be honest with you, the odds are better if he throws the ball high and at the top of the box to Marshall. I mean, and part of what the quarterback's job is when he goes through his progressions, he's supposed to find the best matchup or the best percentage of success on a given pass. And, you know, if I'm Eli and I really think that Odell's covered, I'm not going to throw a high ball to him and ask him to high point the ball. I'm going to Marshall.
That's the whole
or Shepard.
And that's the whole point.
Or Ingram.
A guy like Marshall and Ingram, too, because they have a little bit more size.
I mean, I'm not going to force the ball into Odell just because I think he can jump high and get it. Yeah. That's crazy.
That's playing. You know what that is? That's playing to the cameras, essentially.
It's also playing into the defense's hands.
It is, too. But their goal is not to put on a show offensively. It's to execute.
Right.
That's what their goal is.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anything else for us, Christian?
Well, yeah, I mean, I wasn't saying that they should put any emphasis on it. I'm just saying that it's more of a possibility where it can happen more than a couple times a year. I mean,
I would hope not because I don't want Eli forcing the ball.
Right. Well, like I said, that's what they signed Michael for. But, I mean, there's just a handful of plays throughout Beckham's career so far where he does throw a high for him, and he just makes a crazy play for a touchdown.
Yeah, but I guess what Paul is saying, and I would agree with it, is that you can't just assume that that's going to happen every time. I would be willing to take my fair share of chances with Odell Beckham because of that track record, but that doesn't mean the offensive philosophy should be, well, we should average 8 or 9 times Eli throwing the ball up because there's a good chance Odell's going to come to the rescue, especially when you have Brandon Marshall, Evan Ingram, and you hope that the running game improves, Chris. Now, I just think he got more weapons The whole point is to try to utilize them and keep the defense off balance. Because think about this, then you become predictable to the defense.
Again, we're missing the point here. The idea is to throw the ball to the open man.
Yeah.
It's not that we want to see Odell making high point catches. That's not what you want. Okay? I'd be happy if Odell doesn't make a single high point catch all season. That's not what you want.
Well, yeah, I'm not necessarily saying to plan for it. I'm just saying that it's still a possibility if all else isn't looking so well.
Well, you'd like to believe with all the options they've loaded up with this year that there will be other avenues to throw the ball to.
Hi, Christian.
Right, and yeah. I was just going to say, you know, there'll just be some plays throughout the season, but I guess that some of that has already been there too, so...
Well, that's always an option, but getting back to the main point today, Christian, I appreciate the phone call, is there's no point of taking those risks throughout the course of a game when you have more than other adequate options to spread the wealth.
I just
don't think it's necessary.
I think it's very fair to say if Eli did take those risks and force the ball into Odell, and quite honestly, he's been accused of doing that more than once over the course of the last couple of seasons. He was accused of doing that when Cruz went out 2 years ago with injury. People said that Odell was the only receiver he had, and he was forcing too many. Remember, there were critics who said Odell's getting too many targets.
And Cruz is not getting enough, because remember, you'd look.
Cruz then this
make,
past year.
Cruz would make one catch, and everybody's like, why don't you use Cruz more? And Eli's like, I'm just going to go where the defense dictates I should go. I'm not just going to try to get it to a guy just for the sake of getting it to a guy.
So, you know, I understand what the caller's saying, but, you know, you can't have it both ways. And the logic says you want to take the path of least resistance. And that says you don't force it to Odell. You don't want him making spectacular catches if he doesn't have to. And you want to believe that you've built enough of an arsenal here with the weaponry that the Giants have been able to put together that there should be at least one guy open on every pass play with the kind of guys that they can put on the field. Anyway.
And even if nobody's overwhelmingly open, you figure somebody's in a position to make a play as opposed to chucking it up to Odell Beckham.
And probably that's going to be Marshall because you figure he's going to have a height advantage over anybody who may be in good position to cover him anyway. I'll tell you one thing I don't want to see, Eli run.
Yes. Though when he has run a few times,
I'd rather him
I know. No, I guess I'm so caught up in the last caller that the point is, well, when Eli's run, he's dazzled, so let him run a little bit more. That's the last possible option, even though I understand from a visual perspective it may be fun to see here.
To this day, there are guys on this team, well, not so much anymore because they're all gone, but if you remember in 2007 when in London on that wet turf against the Dolphins, Eli scrambled around the end for a touchdown on that wet and soggy soccer grass surface that they had had over in England. And I know for years and years, guys who were still teammates of his would tell him about how they had seen an eclipse by the time he had scored. Because it just took forever.
Slow motion. It was like watching slow motion in real life. That's essentially what it was like. We were talking earlier about Dave Gettleman, and Dave, our producer, brought up a good point. When Sean McDermott went to the Buffalo Bills as their new head coach, Sean McDermott used to be the Panthers' defensive coordinator. He took the assistant general manager in Carolina, Brandon Bean, with him to become the new GM. So technically, Carolina took a hit already in their front office, and now they get rid of Gettleman.
Wow.
So they may actually be in a position where they're looking at more external candidates than somebody internally, considering they lost their number one and their number two in the front office. But to me, it's the timing of everything that is very interesting.
I don't know if they open this week or next week.
Yeah, I'm not exactly sure.
Everybody has a bit of a different day for their opening and when players report. Giants, of course, are a week from Thursday. I will say this. I am not a Cam Newton fan. I've said that on this show before. I respect his talents. I respect his ability. I do not respect his mentality, his demeanor, his immaturity, his lack of leadership skills. He is too much of a big crybaby for me. Too many times when things break down, he sulks, he pouts, he loses his composure, he's always pointing the finger at somebody else. I respect the heck out of his talent. The man has incredible physical tools. He would never be a quarterback on my team. I'm just saying.
No, it just gets me thinking about celebrations and touchdowns. I knew the minute Cam came into the league and he celebrated on a touchdown, I knew you would never consider taking him on
the team.
Let's face it.
I don't need that either, but I'm
surprised you didn't lead off with that.
Well, because that's not what would make me not want him. It is, I don't want him more for his deficiencies than his excessiveness. But yeah, you want to throw that in there too? That's another reason
well,
not
to
like
I'm giving
him.
You more ammunition.
Absolutely.
Well, you know, you and I look at it different in terms of the emotion and the celebration, and that's fine. Honestly, when I look at Cam's career, your point about, you know, maybe getting into minutia, as I like to say it, and not looking at the big picture throughout his career, I get that point. But the biggest criticism I have of Cam in any type of game is probably the Super Bowl when the fumble occurred, and I didn't think that he made enough of an effort to try to cover up the fumble. That's the only thing that if I was actually critiquing his game and putting it under the microscope, when emotion maybe got the better of him, that I would bring to the forefront. Outside of that, the celebration, getting animated at teammates, that's a part of human nature. I personally don't have an issue with that.
Yeah. I don't see it in here. I don't see a winner in here. I just don't.
Well, I don't think, though, that's what has done in the Panthers in previous seasons.
No, no.
I mean, if anything, I think their defense took a hit this past season.
I would agree. They've had a lot
they've
of other
injuries.
Issues. They've had a lot of issues.
Missed the majority. But
that's true.
I thought that.
I still question him being a winner, though.
Well, the year that he lost a lot of personnel, if you remember, you know, they got rid of the entire receiving core. You could understand when you don't have nearly as much talent around you, the numbers perhaps could go down, but they still had a really good, productive running game with D'Angelo Williams and Jonathan Stewart, because when one guy got hurt, they brought in the other. And over the last few years, I think they've done a nice job drafting some young talent at the receiving position, and they also have Greg Olsen. So they've got weapons in Carolina. I never thought putting the team together was an issue for them.
You know what's funny? And anybody who knows my air work knows I'm not a Russell Wilson fan either. However, I think Russell Wilson has infinite more intangibles, leadership skills, maturity, guts, heart, winner. He's got infinite more of those things than Cam Newton does. Cam Newton may have more pure talent, physical strength, ability to throw the ball long, ability to literally run over people. Or
like a linebacker.
Yeah, or quite frankly, to stand up in the pocket when pass rushers are trying to drag him down because he is so strong. He may have more of that. But the intangibles, I'll take Russell Wilson over Cam Newton any day of the week. And I'm not a Russell Wilson fan, as you know. I think he's a system quarterback.
Well, but it's interesting that you make the point that you take Russell Wilson over Cam. And I'm not saying to believe everything you read in the media, because I think that there are some stories with agendas. But I don't know if you saw recently ESPN did a story about the Seahawks and how there was split.
I heard about it.
In
didn't
the locker
read
room.
It.
Okay.
Didn't read
I think it'd be a good read for you. Okay. And I'm not trying to get you to change your perspective of Cam, but the point is that Russell Wilson, not everybody stands behind him in Seattle and the defense especially. So your point about maybe Cam is not a unifying type of player and people are turned off by his emotions and how he conducts himself, some people could bring up the same things about Russell. That's the only reason why I bring that up. That's not to say that that should change your perspective, but I think before we say that guys are on the opposite end of the spectrum, it's interesting that when you're in the locker room, the perspective tends to change when you see how other players react around the quarterback position, which obviously is important not just from an X's and O's standpoint, but from a leadership standpoint.
Well, you know what's funny about that, and I'm going to contradict myself just a little bit here, on the last play against the Patriots that cost them the Super Bowl 2 years ago?
With the Marshawn Lynch?
Yeah.
Not running it with him? Okay.
I still believe that as much as that was Pete Carroll's fault and the offensive coordinator's fault, I think Russell Wilson deserves one-third of that responsibility. Because when he comes up to the line, he sees the play and he doesn't do anything about it. He telegraphs the pass from about 50,000 miles away, and why do you think the corner jumped it? Butler told the world. We saw them line up in that formation. We ran that formation in practice.
They
we knew exactly what they were going to do. And Russell Wilson telegraphed it from 50,000 miles away. So I'm going to contradict myself a little bit here by saying, Russell Wilson, that's on you too, pal. I know he seems to skate free on that. but he shouldn't.
Well, because the focus is so much on the coaches not having to play to run the football.
I know.
As opposed to the dynamics. But I'm glad you brought that up because I think a lot of people don't realize, and I think this was brought up, the point that you made, and I say this all the time when I have conversations about that play, Paul, is it was the piece that the NFL Network did on the Patriots where they recapped that season. Mm-hmm. I forget what the title. It was an hour-long feature.
I remember seeing it.
Something about how to win or something like that.
Yep.
And they had the practice film
yes.
of them going up against that formation.
Yes.
And they failed to execute. I don't know if you noticed it.
That's correct.
They could not stop that play. And then who would have thought, you know, this is where people are going to argue, well, this is how Bill Belichick gets put up on a pedestal, but I also think this is how teams separate themselves from the rest of the pack, where they scout well and they know perhaps mm-hmm. how to prepare their players to go mm-hmm. over that play during the practice week of the Super Bowl. And then for that team to run it on the final play of the Super Bowl says that you're putting your team in a position to thrive, but you're right. Malcolm Butler made a hell of a play, but let's not forget Brandon Browner. If Brandon Browner doesn't get physical on
correct.
The screen,
correct.
Malcolm Butler does not make that play. People always forget about Brandon Browner. Brandon Browner, to me, should get more credit for sparking that play, even though Malcolm Butler got the INT.
I agree, but I'm also, again, I will repeat, I believe that there should be much more criticism on Russ Wilson.
That's fair.
Because he skates on this. And not only did he telegraph it, when he saw that the Patriots did not bite on the pick and that Butler was going to jump the route, Wilson still had the ball in his hands. He could have thrown that thing into the fifth row. He did not have to try to force that ball in there. Russell Wilson had ample opportunity to abort that play, and he didn't. I'm just saying.
I think that's fair.
But here's what I will say. Russell Wilson still seems to have more intangibles than Cam Newton does. The lesser of two evils, because I don't like either one of them, quite frankly. But I'd still rather have Wilson over Cam Newton.
201-939-4513 is the telephone number, hashtag Giants Chat. I know we did get a few questions. We already addressed it about if Ezekiel Elliott is suspended, how that could impact the philosophy of the Cowboys and the Giants in week number one. And Paul and I pretty much said that. We don't think it's going to have a huge impact, mainly because I think Dallas has depth at running back. They're built with that offensive line, and the Giants match up very well with the Cowboys in terms of their strategy. The other thing I wanted to bring up before we wrap up the program, the Giants 30 Questions in 30 Days feature is something that I advise everybody to check out. We have video clips where we've answered all the questions. We also have written paragraphs where we've all chimed in terms of what we think.
I want to do some more of those tomorrow because I do have one tweet here that I want to get to if it's okay.
Sure.
Mort Christensen, at Mort Christensen, wants to mention Bavaro in terms of throwing him into the hat with Huff and Gifford as guys who he thinks should have been on the all-time Monday morning quarterbacks NFL draft, and I'm going to say no. And I'm a huge Mark Bavaro fan and think he was a Hall of Fame caliber player. But remember, one of my requirements for true greatness and Hall of Fame credentials is longevity. And Mark Bavaro, in my mind, he falls into that Don Mattingly category, that Thurman Munson category in baseball. You know, not enough great years with the longevity. When you take the longevity out of it, he becomes an almost Hall of Famer. So I just want to throw that out there because we did get a tweet about it, and I appreciate, look, Mark Bavaro, just huge thumbs up. Love the guy. I mean, he's a friend of mine. Great, great player. But you know what? No. He's Hall of Fame caliber player, but not a Hall of Famer. I don't know. What's your thought?
Well, keep in mind, 300 players were taken amongst the 25 rounds. I don't know how many people are inducted into the Pro Football Hall of Fame
you know
off
what?
The top of my head. Do
I'm
we gonna, know?
I'm going to look at that right,
all
right now.
If you want to look that up, but here's the thing, though. There's a lot of coaches and executives that are in the Hall of Fame, too.
That's true.
So you really have to know how many players are in the Pro Football Hall of Fame. The point that I want to make as you look that up is that if only 300 players were taken in this draft,
mm-hmm.
one of the criteria would have to be almost that you're in the Hall of Fame because we're talking about the greatest players of all time.
Yes.
I mean, the talent pool
that's a good
is
point.
Humongous. in order for...
Although, like, Tom Brady is not in the Hall of Fame, but
true.
He was drafted.
Well, but that makes it even more challenging, I guess, because if you're taking into consideration the greats in the current game that haven't been inducted, you're also considering the pool of Hall of Famers. When you start talking about, and this is no disrespect to a guy like Mark Bavaro, I think was one of the toughest NFL players all time.
Oh, yeah.
But you have to draw the line at a point where you may have respect for the player, but they're not making the cutoff for the top 300 in the NFL. So, I mean, you have to look at it through that lens to understand. That's why a lot of players who maybe you think are great, there's no way they're going to be selected. See, our discussion about Frank Gifford's a Hall of Famer. So that conversation is warranted. Frank Gifford was a Hall of Famer. He wasn't included in the top 300.
So
Sam Huff, too. But when you start bringing in guys that are not even in the Hall of Fame and you're surprised that they make the top 300, it's hard to sit here and make an argument.
Yeah, I can't do it. There are 310 members
total
in the Hall of Fame total.
Okay. So,
but I don't see anything here that indicates specifically how many players, how many contributors.
And how many overlap, because there's a lot of coaches that both played. So, but here's the thing. I think it's safe, Paul, to assume there's less than 300 players based on your number.
Oh, I don't think there's any question.
Pro Football Hall of Fame. So there's definitely less Hall of Famers than the amount that they drafted in these 25 rounds, but you're still only leaving – a very small window open to then take into consideration players that are still in the league today that haven't made the Hall of Fame, who you have to take, like Tom Brady, you mentioned.
Sure.
And then the group of peripheral players that are borderline Hall of Fame, or, I mean, Paul, think about the guys that retired that are not even in the Hall of Fame. For example, Terrell Owens. Terrell Owens is a Hall of Famer. Today, he's not in the Hall of Fame, but you would certainly consider him when you're making that draft.
I would vote for him. Too short. Career too short.
Well, that's your criteria.
I know. I mean, it's an important part for me.
We should have an entire show, Paul Dottino's criteria to determine how great you are. And forget just as a football player, just as an individual. Doing football is way too easy for you.
And by the way, in terms of the Hall of Fame, you know, we're talking about guys who are in and who are waiting and stuff like that. It's funny because – you talk about the Baseball Hall of Fame, and over the years, Gil Hodges was always the poster child for, like, the guys who should be in. And you couldn't name too many others. He was the one who everybody would name every year. Like, oh, Gil Hodges, he's going to get... In pro football, for the longest time, you could have made an entire starting lineup of 11 offense and 11 defense. Guys, at least the guy at every position, who was justifiably Hall of Fame material and wasn't in. They had done a bad job for a long time. They're starting to do better now, you know, getting some of those guys in. But, you know, you go back 10, 20 years ago, there were a lot of guys that they were leaving out. The Football Hall of Fame was not as inclusive as it should have been. It's getting better, but I just mentioned that.
Well, and speaking of that, we're going to have the Hall of Fame inductions coming up next month.
Yeah.
Right around the Hall of Fame preseason game. So we'll certainly revisit the class of 2017. With that being said, that is going to wrap up things for us today here on Big Blue Kickoff Live. Appreciate all the tweets. Appreciate all the phone calls. We're with you each and every week till Thursday, though, this week, because no shows on Fridays during the course of the summer, at least until training camp starts. But we'll continue the dialogue on the latest NFL news, and we'll get more into the 30 questions in 30 days. As I mentioned, if you have an opportunity, check it out on Giants.com. Check out the videos. Check out the written descriptions. Want to hear your thoughts on the answers to a number of these questions as we start to get closer to training camp. There's a lot of questions looming across the board for this team, so your input is certainly important to us here on the program. For Paul Dottino, I'm Lance Meadow. Enjoy the rest of your Monday. Right here on Giants.com. Have a good one.